Wretched Radio begins in 3, 2, 1.
To convince a child to keep walking, try switching roles with them. Let the child play the role of the parent. They'll immediately do what you want them to do.
You are raising in your home people that the Bible is very clear about their status. They need to be converted. Not just the conformity of their behavior. They need a transforming encounter with the gospel of Jesus Christ. That is the ultimate priority.
It's time for Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Got something that might help you out when you are evangelizing and you hear the... the old objection. Hey, what about all the evil in the world? That proves God doesn't exist. Or does it? This is Wretched Radio from thelife.com. The destruction of the Canaanites. Scenario. What if there were a culture where human sacrifices were normal? And in a sense, they are. Aren't they? With abortion. The human sacrifices for our convenience. I was thinking about the argument that we sometimes use in the pro-life movement. Why is it that we have laws protecting bald eagle eggs, but not human eggs, if you will? Why is that? Little inconsistent. Because you recognize that a bald eagle is going to become a bald eagle from an egg to a branch sitting on a perch or in an eggshell. It's a bald eagle. Why don't you want to kill that fertilized egg? Because inside of it is a bald eagle, which you esteem to be precious. And that's why I was thinking about it, because it's still the same thing as a person deciding to take the life of a child. It is because of our preference. What is it that we desire? From what do we receive the most benefit? We have made a decision as a culture that we value bald eagle eggs because we love bald eagles. Similarly, as a society, we've said we don't value human life. Therefore, we don't value what is in the womb of a pregnant woman. Either one is the same. The big person, based on their needs, their desires, making a determination of what we want and who we're going to let live or not. Both issues are the same, whether it's bald eagle or babies. It's about being a bully. It is about the big people making the decision. Imagine a society where human sacrifices were normal. Not limited to the occasional sacrifice at a local temple, but on the commonplace level of parents and children. At their house. Hey, Bob. What are you going to do today? Well, when I'm done mowing the lawn, I'm going to sacrifice one of my kids. Okay, so you're going to cut your grass and then kill one of your kids. Yeah. What are you doing? I'm going to watch a game and then sacrifice one of my children. Busy weekend. That's what we're talking about here. And what if the same society had abandoned all sexual restraint? We're getting there. Practicing sex between parents and children. We're getting there. Between siblings and between people and animals. Imagine a culture like that. You're observing it. You're seeing it. And what if justice became virtually non-existent and evil and corruption were the rule? How would you see that culture? If it were in your power to stop that gratuitously evil society. Question, would you do it? In other words, you're God. You have power to determine if a society continues existing or snuffing it out. And you see a culture that is gratuitously evil to the point of sacrificing their own children, killing them as they see fit, even as a sacrifice to appease you, making it even worse. Sexually, it's totally debauched, not just behind closed doors, but it's out in the front lawn. It's on the buses. It's in the streets. It's on the TV. It's everywhere. And it is rampant. There's little or no curbing of it, and there's no justice. You kill somebody, no problem. You molest somebody, no problem. Would you stop it? Or would you just let the evil and injustice and suffering spread like a disease, resulting in more evil? Here's another question. Is it possible that a perfectly good, all-powerful, and all-knowing God requires the destruction of a society if it becomes sufficiently evil? Could God ever do such a thing? Can we ever imagine a society that is so debauched that we would say, yeah, it's right for God to wipe that out? Well, if you would consider doing it, and I think that you would, doesn't God have the right to do it? So now the question is, what was the situation? What was the status of the Canaanite culture? 400 years before the destruction of the Canaanite society, God told Abraham that he could not have that land for another 400 years because the evil of the Canaanites had not yet reached what we'll call the tipping point. 400 years later, when horrific customs, parents offering their kids as human sacrifice, sexual depravity, complete moral breakdown, sex between parents and children, siblings, humans, animals, bestiality, were being practiced by the culture in general, God ordered then the Israelites to destroy the Canaanites. When people say, how could God wipe out an entire... That's just mean on his part. That's evil of God. No, it's not. That was the goodness of God and the patience of God. He waited 400 years and they never relented. And God said the same thing would happen to Israel when their culture became gratuitously evil, which came to pass, by the way, in the Babylonian annihilation of Israel 700 years later. That God, after a while, says, I got enough. And that doesn't mean that God is cruel for wiping out a nation. It means that he's actually good because he hates evil that much. More from The Life, Why Evil and Injustice Point to the Existence of God. He's using a theologian here that is a little bit controversial, so I won't say his name. We'll just lift the material. Just as it would be absurd to complain about a high crime rate if there were no laws in existence, you shouldn't be complaining about evil in the world if, in fact, there's no standard of beauty and goodness to violate. Quote, my argument against God, wrote this theologian, was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. How could evil exist and a good and loving God exist at the same time? But how did I receive this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line a crooked line, or crooked rather, unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own. But if I did that, my argument against God collapsed. So this was an unbeliever who was warring against God, holding on to his atheism by saying, because evil exists, God can't. So if he realized, wait a second, evil can't exist unless God does, he would undermine his own argument, his own polemic against the existence of God. The argument, God can exist if evil exists, depends on saying that there really is something unjust, not that it doesn't please my fancy. Thus, in the very act of trying to prove that God did not exist, I found I was forced to assume that one part of reality, my idea of justice, was full of sense. The next time somebody says to you, God was really cruel, he shouldn't have wiped out those Canaanites, you can remind them of the patience of God and unrestrained evil, and that it is a just God that puts an end to unbridled evil. When they say to you, there's too much evil in this world for God to exist, you can remind them that by simply acknowledging that there is evil, you're acknowledging that God must exist. Their argument against the existence of God is undermined by their argument against the existence of God. Back to this theologian. The moment you say that one set of moral ideas can be better than another, you are in fact measuring them both by a standard and saying that one of them conforms to that standard more nearly than the other. Comparing them both with some real morality, admitting there is such a thing as real right, independent of what people think, and that some people's ideas get nearer to that real right than others. Moral systems, because we recognize some are better than others, tells us there must be a perfect moral system. If we recognize some behavior is closer to good than others, we are therefore acknowledging there is a perfect standard of goodness. That's why when somebody says to you, hey, I don't think God exists because evil exists, you can simply congratulate them for acknowledging God exists. And that is, it's an increasing challenge. I get that. Our world is so far away from God in their thinking right now. Their minds are so darkened. But if you can say to somebody, would you agree that there is absolute evil in the world and that no setting and no societal vote can make it not evil? Can we agree on that? And when they say yes, and they will ultimately have to, congratulate them for acknowledging the existence of God. How far have you taken them, however? You have not converted them. You have simply demonstrated that there is some sort of theistic system by using the transcendental argument for the existence of God. If there is morality, there is a moral lawgiver. Now the question becomes, who is it? That is when you can present the law and the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so the next time somebody brings up to you the objection, God doesn't exist because of evil, you can use their argument to demonstrate that God, not that God doesn't exist, but that he does exist, but don't stop there in your aha moment. Use the law to bring about the knowledge of sin against that God, and then introduce them to the God who is the perfect standard of morality, and who is the one who will punish people for not matching that standard, and who is the one who has sent his Son to die for us because we cannot meet that standard. Don't be afraid at the argument against the existence of God because of evil. This is Wretched Radio. Let's go to Eastern Europe for yet another great story coming out of the Tomorrow Clubs.
Andrea was left by her mother when she was 3 months old. The Tomorrow Club director decided to pray for this girl and she repented. She used to be a sad-looking kid. Now, seems like that smile never comes off her face.
So many kids are abandoned by parents who need to go to other countries to make a living. They donate their organs. They leave the kids. They are lost physically and spiritually. And the Tomorrow Clubs finds them. They teach them the gospel. They help them to memorize Bible verses. They even will help them with their family lives. It's a magnificent ministry, story after story coming out of Eastern Europe. $30 a month, 30 disciples. Tomorrow Clubs is the ministry. Would you please consider supporting a club of your own? TomorrowClubs.org/wretched.
Does this sound familiar? It's Saturday night, and there you are on your computer, and you decide to watch a video of John MacArthur. And the next thing that you know, you're 3 hours deep in YouTube watching a baby giraffe trying to stand up. Hey, it's happened to all of us. Instead of watching random videos and losing all sense of time, we suggest visiting wretched.org. There are hundreds of hours of biblically based TV and radio, and a library full of hand-picked content specifically for you. Over 2,400 30-minute TV programs with subjects ranging from abortion and apologetics to systematic theology and hermeneutics. Wretched's hour-long radio programs posted every day tackle tough issues that we all face today. That's not all. Every Monday, you can expect to hear Grace to Use, Phil Johnson, on Too Wretched for Radio with Todd. So the next time you're just wandering the web watching baby giraffe videos, head on over to wretched.org. Wretched.org.
What two pastors go through to bring Bibles to their parishioners in the Philippines.
Two pastors, they had to rise up 3 a.m. and walk for 2 hours. And after that, they have to ride a bangka across the river for an hour and then walk again for 3 hours just to get hold of those precious Bibles. They will return in the same way again to bring those Bibles to people whom they are ministering.
That is what they go through. What must you and I do to bring those Bibles to believers around the globe? Pick up our phones. Call Bible League International. Would you do that right now? $5 per Bible. Could you send 7 per month? Call Bible League International right now, and they will be delivered to the hands of a believer. 1-800-YES-WORD. Just giving you a chance to write that down or to call it. 1-800-YES-WORD to bring Bibles to believers through Bible League International. 1-800-YES-WORD.
Names of God. We learn a lot about God from the names given to him in Scripture. One name is Jehovah Sitkinu, the Lord of our righteousness. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21 tells us, that God made Jesus, who knew no sin to be sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Do you ever experience four or more of these? This is Wretched Radio. Panic attacks. A lot of people get them. What are they? You must experience four or more of these for it to be a panic attack. Pounding heart or rapid heart rate. Sweating. Trembling or shaking. Shortness of breath or a smothering sensation. Chest pains. Feeling dizzy, lightheaded, or faint. Feeling of choking, numbness or tingling, chills or hot flashes, nausea, feeling detached, fear of losing control, fear of dying. According to the DSM 5th edition, if you ever experience four of those at the same time, congratulations, you're having a panic attack. Now the question is, can the Bible, a 2,000-year-old book that was written, you know, when people were really dumb, you know, just stupid people, they didn't have science and stuff, does the Bible help us with our panic attacks? Would like to suggest to you, yes, it does. It has much to say. And just like any other form of counseling that never promises it's a get-quick-fix scheme, progressively, God can help you with your panic attacks. And it has worked over and over again for countless people. I hold in my never nicotine-stained fingers a booklet called Help, I Get Panic Attacks. Would encourage you to have these booklets in your church, in your narthex. That would be the lobby. These are booklets. You can get these at Shepherd's Press, shepherdpress.com. And that's Ted Tripp's ministry. It's the Help series, and they've got dozens and dozens of them. Help, I get panic attacks. Help, I have cancer. Help, I just lost a loved one. Help, I have bipolar. Help, and they're great resources to have in your life. Now, they're not a thorough treatment of every single subject, of course, but they get people down the road to demonstrate the Bible can help you with your fill-in-the-blank progressively. This booklet from Lucy Ann Moll, I got to tell you something, it just thrilled my cold conservative heart to read it, because I've got a booklet that will be launched in the fall of 2020 about suicide, depression, anxiety that leads to the taking of life. And so much of what I say in that book aimed at somebody who is suicidal, she's saying to the same person who has panic attacks. Because the Bible's help for you is grounded in the same thing. Do you know what that thing is? Truth. Truth. Why are you having a panic attack? Now, to be clear, if you've ever had a panic attack, you would argue with me that this is not a truth issue. This is just a freak out issue. It's just something happens where my body goes just bonkers. I understand that. I can have that sensation with needles. They kind of make me just a little bit something going into my body. It's not food or it's not oxygen through my nose. I don't like that. And it kind of like makes me a little wiggy. I think it's a vasovagal response where your body just goes, danger, Will Robinson, panic. And you get weird. You can even pass out from that stuff. Haven't done that yet, but I wouldn't be shocked if I did. And you would say, well, that's physiological. And I would say to you, okay, in this instance, let's just say that it is. It still points to what the Bible teaches about the brain, and that is our noggins are kafritz. My thinking is so fallen, broken, and busted, it reacts totally wrong. Even if I'm not processing anything, I'm not thinking it through in any sort of logical fashion. It just happens. And you know this. If you have fear of heights, for instance, it's totally illogical. You're not thinking it through, and all of a sudden you look down and your body just goes bonkers. Same thing can be true with panic attacks. just overcomes you. You don't even know why. This doesn't mean that we need to take medication for it. It's still a thinking issue. It's still a broken brain problem. It's still a truth issue. My body, even if I am not cognitively processing why I am freaking out here, my body's still doing that. And now I need to straighten out that thinking from its crookedness to align it with reality so that I don't have a panic attack anymore. And that is exactly what Lucianne Moll, M-O-L-L, she writes about in this book that, help, I get panic attacks. She got them. Driving home one day, suddenly being on a freeway, I'm going to, like, pull over. I'm going to kill somebody because I'm going to pass out or I'm going to just be out of control. And so I'm going to get off the road. Now, was there anything rational about it? No. Now, caveat, does that mean that there are no dangers on the freeway? Of course they are. And there are times when our body should respond quite, oh, danger! Somebody's pointing a gun at you. Yeah, I think you can be in a little bit of a panic over that. That's rational. But suddenly, looking down from a high place that is perfectly safe, you are encased with railings that are sound, to freak out or to be afraid to open up the door because out there in the sunlight, I just completely unravel. Agoraphobia, or acrophobia. Agoraphobia is outside.
Fear of marketplace.
Fear of the, yeah, that's right. Fear of the marketplace. And then arachnophobia is a fear of spiders. Now, Should you have a fear of spiders? Yeah, well, they can hurt you. Should your body just do a complete freak out and now I never want to leave the house because there could be spiders out there? Well, that's irrational. And so what needs to happen is my thinking needs to be brought into alignment with the truth. Panic attacks often proceed from faulty thinking. And then she gives a word of encouragement. By God's grace, you can change fearful thinking patterns into God-transformed faithful thinking. It's going to require a willingness to trust and obey God and to persevere, because it can take some time. Your faulty thinking didn't develop overnight. It's not going to go away overnight. But when you learn to realign your thoughts with God's thoughts, your panic attacks can become a thing of the past. I got to tell you, this just brings me such joy. I've uttered that sentence multiple times, and I've never met Lucianne, and I don't think she's ever met me. So why do we talk the same way? Because this is what the Bible prescribes for us, that our thoughts need to get realigned with God's thoughts. Furthermore, God can use your panic attacks for good. You might someday be able to help others out of this. Your panic attack might reveal something inside of you that reveals a sin area that needs to be fixed. Or your panic attack can cause you to trust God more and more. Now, wouldn't all of those things be positive benefits from your panic attack? Of course they are. There's got to be something good inside of your panic attack. Otherwise, you wouldn't have panic attacks. Why? Because God doesn't do anything but things that are good for His children. My panic attack is good for me? Yes. How can you say such a thing? Because the Bible says that. God works all things for your good. He doesn't work out something that is good for you after it is done. The thing that is being done for you is good. The only question is, what is it? There will be a good... Let's just say for yucks, just fanciful scenario. You've got panic attacks. And in order to get over them, you need to spend making this... Don't look for holes in this scenario. The prescription for you is to spend 3 hours a day in the Bible. That's what's going to fix you. There you go. There's your prescription right there. You telling me that's a bad thing? You telling me that isn't going to help you? You telling me that isn't going to grow you? You telling me that that isn't going to make you more and more like Jesus Christ? What would be the fruit of that? All because of your panic attacks. There is something good in it. Now, too often these days, and I'm not saying that it should be taken off the table, but too often these days, what do? We medicate it, we cover it up, and what do? You lose the blessing. If you numb it, If you use alcohol, for instance, and by the way, as an aside, more and more people use an alcohol. Now, here it is right here. Alcohol killing more and more Americans than ever. 72,000 alcohol-related deaths among people over the age of 16 in 2017. So many times they're using it to numb. To the Christian, you should go, no, I'm not going to numb the problem. I'm going to figure out the problem. I'm going to apply God's solution to the problem, and then I'm going to be better on the other end of this problem. Alcohol robs you of that blessing. By the way, the majority of alcohol-related deaths involve men. The climb in deaths over time, however, has been increasing faster for women. You figure that one out, but nevertheless, alcohol and a numbing of your panic attacks will rob you. Medication will rob you of the blessing. I'm not taking medication off the table totally, but don't rob yourself of the blessing of becoming more like Jesus Christ, because God is using the tool of a panic attack. How to get one's thinking in alignment with God's, specifically regarding panic attacks, courtesy of Lucy Ann Moll. Help, I get panic attacks next on Wretched Radio.
Titles of Christ. In the Bible, Jesus is given many titles that teach us about who He is and what He has done. Jesus is called the propitiation for our sins. Propitiation means a wrath-removing sacrifice. Jesus bore God's wrath on our behalf, and in return, we receive His righteous standing before God the Father. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Who wouldn't like to have their soul delighted? This is Wretched Radio, Psalm 94:19, Rexella. When my anxious thoughts multiply within me, your consolations delight my soul. Want your soul delighted? Maybe God is causing you to have some sort of anxiety, panic attack, so that you can trust His promises and your soul can be delighted. How poignant is the Bible? How probing? This has got a Southern Baptist sermon written all over it. It's poignant, it's probing, and it's powerful. The Word reads you while you are reading it. God permitting or causing difficult things, maybe even panic attacks, just an utter freaking out of a situation, so that you can increasingly lean on Him, read His Word, and your soul will be delighted. Let's dive into a book, Help, I Get Panic Attacks, Lucy Ann Moll, helping us to understand what panic attacks are and how to get over them. If you recall, it's not just being anxious or upset on occasion. It's more of a, your body's out of control. You feel like you're in a free fall, just absolute terror. Shortness of breath, chest pain, dizzy, nausea, hot flashes, feeling detached, losing control, sweating, pounding heart, trembling or shaking. Wow. This is... Uh-oh. We might need to... This might need to be updated, because that's pretty much how I feel every time I finish at Taco Bell. Nevertheless, let's jump into this booklet to see if we can figure out how we can be helped with our panic attacks. 1 Samuel 17, 8 through 11. Why have you not come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. And Goliath the Philistine said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all of Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. I love the Old Testament. One more reason not to detach it. We can learn something about panic attacks. What's being described here? Dismayed and greatly afraid. Now, it might be not on the scale of the complete type of feeling, but it's getting close. contrast how they responded, Saul and the other Jewish people in Israel, dismayed and greatly afraid. David's response to Goliath wasn't panicky at all. He was a teenager. He should have had some fits, trying on Saul's armor, getting his stones ready, hearing the taunts of the giant. How's about his brothers ridiculing him? But he reacted totally different. Same section of Scripture, 1 Samuel 17. He remembered God had prepared him as a shepherd boy who protected the sheep and struck down bears and lions. And he knew that God then had equipped him, prepared him to deal with this pesky giant. And so what did he have? Not fear and not panic. He actually had confidence. It's as simple as that. David was trusting God. Saul and the Jews weren't. Now, I get it, how that plays out. It's longer, it's harder than that. But that is the historical narrative to show us what is going on when we have panic attacks. We are not believing God. We're not trusting God rightly. Now, this is not to say that you're not saved. It's just that you're not trusting God the way that you should. Some people would say, hey, in fact, I received an email from somebody. What you're describing sounds a lot like prosperity promises. If you have more faith, you'll have more money. It sounds like word of faith. If you have more faith, you'll be healed. Are you saying that if you just have more faith, you won't be anxious? Yes. Yes, I am. Is it the same thing? Yes, it is, but their promise is false. There's no promise that if you have more faith, you are going to be physically healed. There's no promise that if you have more faith, you're going to have money. Is there a promise in the Bible, though, that as you have increasing faith in God, you'll have less anxiety? Absolutely. And so I don't want to say that it's not the same thing that the Word of Faith Prosperity people are doing. I'm saying one promise is biblical and the other promises are not. God does not promise nothing but cash, nothing but perfect health. Look at all the prosperity preachers as they read through their glasses, as they take trips to the hospital. And by the way, it's not uncommon for these prosperity preachers to do that through the back door of a hospital because they know if they are seen going into a hospital to receive help that their theology is outed. There's no promise of that, but yes, God does promise. An increasing trust in Him brings about a peaceable fruit of calm and even joy, and we see that with Saul and David. So don't reject this. Is it? And it's not as simple as, well, just get more faith. And then you won't be all anxious and depressed and stuff. We want to teach how that happens and what God does for us as we struggle. Some examples from the Bible. The Israelite size, armor, bravado, 1 Samuel 17:24. They thought Goliath more powerful than God's promises. So we see an example of David trusting God and being calm in the heat of battle. The reluctant prophet Jonah, who sulked and prayed for death. He asked God to please take my life from me, chapter 4. Jonah's wrong interpretation was that God would serve his desires rather than show compassion for the Ninevites. So what was wrong with Jonah? Why was Jonah wanting to die? Because he didn't think that God's promises were the best, that God's way was the best. Sarah, the wife of Abraham, who laughed cynically. Why? Because she wasn't trusting that God could actually deliver. She was afraid, says Genesis 18:15. God couldn't pull this thing off miraculously. She was beyond childbearing years. In each of those cases, what do we see in these historical narratives? The characters were focusing on what? Their circumstances, rather than God and His power. They were trusting that what was in front of them that they could see was bigger than God. They deemed their circumstances to be dreadful, concerned that they wanted something to happen, victory over the giant, obliteration of an enemy, the birth of an heir, that it might not happen. God had said it's gonna. They said, I don't think so. Or they didn't want it to happen. They focused on the difficulties of the future, temporal matters, and self. And so they're anxious, and you will be too. So some help from Lucy Ann Mohl, Help, I Get Panic Attacks. It helps to know the root of our fear. The root of ungodly fear is belief in a lie. It is a wrong faith. It is a small faith, which is why we are troubled. You're not trusting the right thing. And increasingly, you need to trust in God and not in circumstances. From the booklet, you may not hanker for an HGTV home or a Lexus, but you may desire one or more of these things: peace, security, comfort, significance, respect, love, or approval. And when you fear losing what you desire, anxiety grows like a weed. In other words, it's a good desire, but when you're wanting that, needing that, and it's got to happen, otherwise you won't be happy, you're trusting in something that is shifting. Name something you treasure that plays into your panic. What is it? What is something that is going on in your panic that you're wanting? Peace, security, significance, respect, love, approval. Maybe it's as simple as that. If I go outside of the house and I go out into the streets, people are going to see by my clothing that I am not successful, and I crave their approval. I want them to think that I'm successful. They're going to see that I'm not. Therefore, you panic. I don't know, I'm just making one up. But that's what you're invited to do, encouraged to do. Figure out what is the desire, what is the thing that you're needing so much that it's causing you to freak if you don't get that thing. Nothing wrong with wanting peace, security, comfort, respect, love, approval. Who doesn't want those things? The problem is when you want those things more than you want God. When you're putting more stock in them, when those things are your idol and God is not. If your overarching desire is, well done, good and faithful servant, well, then those other things, they get put in place. And you don't panic. Question. If you're having panic attacks, what are you trusting? What are you idolizing? What are you desiring? Identify that. Kick that off of the throne of your life. Increasingly put God there by reading His Word, applying His Word, and trusting His Word. You will grow in faith. And who will fear man when God is in control? The fear of man, it is a snare, but trusting in God will remove that fear. Is it an overnight sort of affair? No, it's not. It is progressive. But it will work, it has worked, and God promises that it will work for you. This is Wretched Radio.
Thanks for being here today. Glad you would spend part of it listening to Wretched Radio. And thanks for sharing your questions, comments, conundrums, and snarks, and your wretched stories with us. Two easy ways to do that. Idea@wretched.org, the old faithful email. idea@wretched.org, or voicemail us, Beep Talk, 1-877-282-BEEP. Questions, comments, conundrums, snarks, your wretched story, all are welcome. All we ask is on the Beep Talk, you please keep it pithy, and if you would, no swearing, because it really wreaks havoc on Joey's delicate sensibilities. Thank you for that. 1-877-282-BEEP or idea@wretched.org. And if you would like to help make more wretched stories possible, would you become a wretched monthly gospel partner? So if you would, pray on it, please, and get all the details on becoming a gospel partner at wretched.org/donate. wretched.org/donate. Wretched. Amazing grace. Amazing gospel.
No doubt, if you've spent even a minute listening to conservative media, you have been whipped into a frenzy. The problems with our society, the collapse of a culture, the statistics, the legislation. We got to do something about this, but then we're never told what to do. I believe the greatest social ill of our time is the war against the unborn. Millions of children being killed in our country during our lifetime. And we can do something about it, and we can practically get engaged in the war for life. preborn.org/wretched. $28 will provide an ultrasound 80% of the time. It saves the life of a child. Let's not just be righteously indignant. Let us do something to save lives. The women hear the gospel, they receive support, and they choose life. $28 for an ultrasound. preborn.org/wretched.
Thanks very much to the generosity of our monthly gospel partners. Now, if you watch or listen to Wretched on a regular basis, would you consider becoming a gospel partner? See, our content, what we do, is only available because of the generous support of our gospel partners. Thanks to them, you can find full Wretched radio and TV episodes at the home of all things Wretched, wretched.org, among many other free resources. You see, without our gospel partners, there is no Wretched. So, if you enjoy watching or listening to Wretched and would like to continue to do so, consider please becoming a Wretched monthly gospel partner. Visit wretched.org/donate for all the details. And please know that we will be faithful stewards of your money. Right now, 83% of every dollar goes to ministry work. Consider becoming a gospel partner. Go to wretched.org/donate.
God has given the church many gifts for the building up of the body. One gift is teaching, the spiritual ability to explain and apply God's word. A teacher studies to gain knowledge of the Bible, is equipped with wisdom to understand it, and is gifted with the ability to explain it to others so they can grow in God's truth and apply it to their daily life. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Story time here on Wretched Radio. This is going to be quite a journey. Great Britain to Bangkok. Back to England we go. Richard Hoskins, he's an author. Rather popular one, apparently, writing some books specifically specializing in criminology books. And he's also a criminologist working with police, specializing in religious crimes. Going to scenes of crimes where religion was involved, not just Christian hate crime stuff or whatever you're perceiving, but if it's some sort of ritual crime, somebody murders somebody and religion is involved, he's the man. 2016, he flew to Bangkok so that he could do the final stages of what he believed was a transition from being a male to a female. And he is not a Christian, but he shares his story because he regrets doing all of that. And now he's trying to encourage anybody else who is struggling with those issues to rethink their mutilation of their own body. He's grateful he did not go all the way with the transition, but he went a long way, and it is a brutal process. He describes things in this article. I had no idea. I think when you and I think about, okay, somebody goes under the knife to do that, it's all based on organs. Oh, no. They do things to your face and to your forehead and to your hairline, and it's brutal. Thought this would be an interesting exploration of the mind of somebody who made that decision, so that you and I don't want to stereotype, but I think this man reveals something that really is the crux of the issue. And I think as believers we identify that, and therefore we know that we can help them with their struggles, because it has far less to do, so it seems, with feeling like you're in the wrong body, although that sensation, whatever that feels like, is there. There tends to be more to the story. I was not suffering from gender confusion at all, he writes. I had no need to transition. My reasons for wanting a new identity, I would eventually learn, were complex and had nothing to do with being male or female. What a bold confession from an unbelieving person who regrets his decision. In fact, I've come to believe that for many of the growing numbers of men, women, and most alarmingly, children wishing to change sex, gender, reassignment is nothing more than escapism. It certainly wasn't my case. October 2009. He was a successful writer dealing with faith-based crimes, ritual murders, was an expert in the field. Successful. He wrote 2012's best-selling book, The Boy in the River, about the case of Adam, a victim of modern-day witchcraft found floating in the Thames River. But by October 2009, a cataclysmic event blew my world apart. My 19-year-old son David climbed 65 feet up an electricity pylon in Weston, Super Mare, and reached for a 33,000-volt cable. Witnesses reported a blue thunderbolt and hearing a buzzing noise. It should have killed him outright, but it didn't. From his hospital bed a few days later, he whispered, "It hurt me so much, Daddy." For 42 days, he held his son in a hospital bed. The sight and smell of my son's scorched flesh and then of rancid infection are now part of me forever. What is that? What is that? If you can't call that trauma, I don't know what you can. We tend to think war and post-traumatic stress, it finds itself manifesting in many different varieties and flavors, and this most certainly is one of them. I said goodbye to him the day before he died on December 4th, 2009. With hindsight, it's not surprising that I chose to leave Richard behind and instead become Rachel. Largely raised by women, I'd had a lifelong admiration for the fairer sex. I love women's wear, and this day, my closest friends acknowledge a sensitive side. Okay, so there's, once again, desire for clothing seems to be a thread in here. Nevertheless, marriage ended following David's death, and I found myself increasingly alone with my thoughts. In the months and years that followed, I turned to my feminine side. It had nothing to do with sex. I was never attracted to men. But it was something that I wanted quite powerfully all the same. What might it be like to put on makeup, to wear those clothes outside, to step into the ladies' bathrooms? I drove down to the local Tesco superstore and filled up a trolley with everything from ladies' briefs to frilly tops, jeans and mascara. It felt both scary and thrilling, watching YouTube videos for makeup tutorials. I learned how to apply subtle tones, lines, hide the stubble. But I soon realized that if I really wanted to change my gender, then I had to go a whole lot deeper than just dressing up in women's clothing. In autumn 2014, I surfed the dark web, where you go to find stuff not thrown up by conventional search engines. I was in search of feminizing hormones, a dangerous step to take, yet one that proved disturbingly easy. So he orders some drugs from Bangkok. They cause him to be sick. I was informed that conventionally, someone wishing to change sex should wait 2 years before being prescribed life-changing hormones. It's not what happened to him. Normally, I would be required to, quote, live in a role first for 2 years. As soon as I discovered, however, the system bends over backwards for anyone who wants to transition, I was not so much fast-tracked as catapulted through the system. Within 6 weeks, I'd been interviewed by all required consultants, a process normally lasting more than 2 years. He takes bag drugs from overseas, goes to the doctor. "What's your issue? I'm taking these drugs." "Oh, well, you should wait 2 years, but boom, we'll get her done in 6 weeks. My surgery took 9 hours when he flew to Bangkok to get it done. When the swelling disappeared, my face would be smaller than before, my forehead a couple of inches shorter and flatter, and my ears apparently smaller. The aftermath of the 9-hour operation was a blur of semi-consciousness, nausea, and pain. I was dimly aware of a nurse trying to wake me by shouting my name, Rachel. I threw up every time I awoke, and my temples felt as if someone had put them in a vise and tightened it another 50 turns. As my 15,000 pounds covered only a one-night stay, I was discharged and had to stagger into a taxi, still carrying my drip and the drainage catheters. My face was scarlet and had a swollen to the size of a basketball. Midnight blue lips were draped across my mouth. When an NHS referral letter to the hospital landed on my doormat 3 months later in March of 2017 for me to undergo the surgery that we think about, I was pushed into thinking for myself. So instead of following the NHS, I took on a private consultation to think it through. I was diagnosed with suffering from, you guessed it, complex post-traumatic stress disorder from multiple severe traumas. I didn't have gender dysphoria or gender confusion as I had thought. I was trying to escape real, visceral, gut-wrenching pain. I had chosen profoundly the wrong way to fix it, and the NHS had been all too ready to help me on the way. What shocks me is that nobody looked deeply into my life story. No one at the gender clinics talked to me what had happened with my son David and about the 42 days I'd spent by his bedside watching him die from his burns. Nor did they bother to find out about the earlier traumas I had suffered. Sexual abuse. Working in the Congo as a young man, I had to bury my first children, twins who became sick and died. Then there were the hundreds of gruesome police cases I had advised on. Seeing that stuff will traumatize you. There was no shortage of clues for anyone who had bothered to look, and if it was true in my case, how many others are similarly misdiagnosed? How many adolescents desperately wishing to change sex are really trying to escape some other form of pain? How many kids are dragged with their distraught mothers to the gender reassignment clinic in London, but they're suffering from poor body image or from the Instagram era? What a transparent story that you typically don't hear about. How many of these individuals that are getting these surgeries, the hormones, are broken, traumatized, hurting people who do not need to go under the knife, but they need truth. They need a mechanism to help them think through things and to understand the awful things that have happened to them. In other words, they need the Bible. They need God. They need their thinking realigned with His thinking. That's what they need. They need salvation, and they need correct understanding and thinking about why the world operates the way that it does and the way that it's supposed to, the reason for it, and what Jesus has done to solve the problem. As we watch this continue to unfold in front of us and ask the question, well, what does it feel like to have the wrong gender? It's gender dysphoria. I think I agree with this author that the issue, it's sin, of course, because we live in a fallen world, and the only way to navigate your way through this curse is by having our minds transformed, renewed by the Word of God. Until tomorrow, go serve your King.